bipartisan negotiations for a stimulus. Those stories and more are coming up this hour. We will also have several pre-recorded reports and the latter portion of our program. Today, those will be dealing mainly with food insecurity because of the pandemic. First, we'll look at the numbers. From the Odessa American this Thursday, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,905. Ector County negative, 22,835 out of 28,051 tested, with 311 pending. 99 deaths. Recovered, 4,163. Active, 643. ECISD daily cases, 5 students, 1 staff. Midland County, 3,857 confirmed, 85 deaths. In Texas, from the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 357 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On September 30th, 5,335 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 149 patients compared with a week ago. As of September 30th, 3,344 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths decreased by 10 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On September 30th, 107 new deaths were reported. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $37.89. That's down $2.33. Now here are coronavirus briefs. President Trump plans to hold large campaign rallies in Wisconsin this weekend, even though his White House Coronavirus Task Force has called for increasing social distancing to the maximal degree possible as the state's caseload surges. La Crosse and Green Bay, where the events will take place, are both considered coronavirus red zones. Monoclonal antibodies are a real best chance of being a game changer for treating the coronavirus, experts say. But there won't be enough to meet demand if the pandemic keeps raging. More than 1 million people across the world have died since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, according to Johns Hopkins University's tally. More than 7.1 million coronavirus cases and 206,000 fatalities have been reported in the United States since February. U.S. records at least 42,000 coronavirus cases in 24 hours. New CDC coronavirus forecast sees a general flattening of deaths. Multiple European countries that were badly affected early in the pandemic are now battling to rein in a second wave. Madrid will go into a form of lockdown amid rising cases. H&M is closing 250 stores because of the coronavirus pandemic. The economic collapse sparked by the pandemic is triggering the most unequal recession in modern U.S. history, overwhelmingly affecting minority and low-wage workers. United Airlines to furlough more than 13,000 employees starting today. American Airlines set to furlough 19,000 workers starting today. Now here are some short articles. From Marfa Public Radio, after nearly a month, mobile testing returns to Presidio County. For the first time in over a month, public testing for the coronavirus will return to the Big Bend region. The Texas Department of Emergency Management will hold 2 drive-through style testing sites, one in Marfa and one in Presidio next week. The upcoming state testing in Presidio County will be open to residents across the Big Bend region. No appointment is required, but personal identification is needed. The test will be an oral swab, and testing will run from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. or until supplies run out. Testing locations. City of Presidio, Tuesday, October 6th. City of Presidio EMS and Fire Station, 100 East FM 170. Marfa, Wednesday, October 7th. Marfa Visitor Center, 302 South Highland Avenue. Testing has also lagged recently in other corners of the Big Bend region, including Alpine. While it's been over a month since there was state-run testing in Brewster County, Emergency Management Coordinator Stephanie Elmore is putting together the region's first public and locally run testing site, according to the Big Bend Sentinel. Two-thirds of Americans miss cancer screenings amid COVID-19, survey suggests. Two-thirds of Americans have delayed or skipped scheduled cancer screenings, such as a mammogram, colonoscopy, skin check, or PAP-HPV test, because of the coronavirus pandemic, according to a survey out Thursday. More than a third of Americans had some sort of cancer screening due during the pandemic this year, but nearly 64% of those surveyed said they had put it off or skipped it altogether, the American Society of Clinical Oncology found, ASCO. While delaying recommended screenings for a few months is not necessarily dangerous, our biggest concern is that a significant number of Americans might stop getting preventative care for long periods of time or altogether, said ASCO Chief Medical Officer Dr. Richard Schilsky. Cancer screenings are critical for detecting cancer early, and early detection is key to successfully treating many cancers. Plus, fewer than half of Americans are doing any of the things known to prevent cancer, such as staying out of the sun or using sunscreen when outside, maintaining a healthy weight, and limiting alcohol, the survey of 4,000 adults found. The survey, conducted online from July 21st to September 8th, also found 59% believe racism can affect the health care a person receives, with black people 76%, Hispanic people 70%, and Asian people 66%, more likely than white people 53%, to hold those views. Despite evidence of worse cancer outcomes for black Americans, few Americans are aware of the established relationship between race and cancer survival, ASCO said in a statement. Fewer than one in five, 19%, believes race has an impact on the likelihood a person will survive cancer, with blacks, 27%, and Hispanics, 22%, significantly more likely than whites, 16%, to be aware of the link. When a vaccine could be available to U.S. population. On Wednesday, Moderna CEO Stephanie Bancole said if its COVID-19 vaccine is proven safe and effective, it could be available to the general population by late March or early April. Moderna began its Phase 3 clinical trial for a COVID-19 vaccine in the U.S. in July. It's one of four companies that have begun Phase 3 COVID-19 vaccine trials in the U.S. The others are Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer-BioNTech, and AstraZeneca. The AstraZeneca trial was paused after an unexplained illness in a volunteer, and U.S. health authorities are still considering crucial questions that remain around the injections of the experimental vaccine. I think a late Q1, early Q2 approval is a reasonable timeline based on what we know from our vaccine, Bancole said at a conference hosted by the Financial Times. But there are several steps that will have to come before that. If the safety and efficacy data checks out, Bancole said he expects Moderna will be able to file a Biologics License Application, BLA, with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration by late January or early February. That application asks the FDA to consider fully licensing a drug, while an Emergency Use Authorization, EUA, expedites a drug candidate for use on an emergency basis. Moderna could file for an EUA as early as November 25th for people who are deemed high priority, including healthcare workers and the elderly, Bancole said at a conference hosted by the Financial Times. Until a vaccine is available, experts have long said the country's most powerful tools against the pandemic are face masks and other safety measures like social distancing. But even when a vaccine is ready, health officials like Fauci have said there will still be room for the virus to spread, and it's unlikely the vaccine will be 100% effective or taken by 100% of the population. I think if we get 75 to 80% of the population vaccinated, I think that would be a really good accomplishment, Fauci said last week. AstraZeneca vaccine trial on hold in U.S., but FDA's Hahn won't reveal why it's confidential. Drug maker AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine trial in the United States is still on hold after a participant developed a serious illness, but the Food and Drug Administration commissioner won't say why. At the U.S. Pharma and Biotech Summit hosted by the Financial Times Wednesday, U.S. FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn was asked why the trial was still on pause in the U.S., even though it has resumed in Europe. Hahn said he couldn't answer. "I can't speak to confidential commercial information, and this summit knows that all too well," he said. "Our agency career officials in general take the issue of serious safety very serious, the protection of the American people very seriously. We will look at any and all data, and we will make a decision when we have the data available to us regarding any issue, whether it's safety or effectiveness." Hahn said that he could not talk about a specific issue that may involve the AstraZeneca trial. "What I can tell you is that FDA is on the job with respect to looking at all the safety and efficacy issues on all medical products," he said. An AstraZeneca spokesperson told CNN earlier that regulators in Britain, Brazil, and South Africa had all decided to resume the trials. "We are continuing to work with the FDA to facilitate review of this information needed to make a decision regarding resumption of the U.S. trial," the spokesperson said. "Regulators in each individual country determine when trials can start, and they do this in their own time frame." Inside the small and independent group that sees vaccine data before anyone else. The Data and Safety Monitoring Board, a group of experts in areas like statistics, ethics, and vaccine development, views unblinded coronavirus vaccine data as it starts to come in, reports CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta. They know who got the vaccine, who got the placebo. They're the ones who figure out if it's time to say this is working. That's not a political decision, according to Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health. They can advise companies to apply for FDA review or might bring a trial to a halt, according to Gupta. Susan Ellenberg, a professor of biostatistics at UPenn's Perelman School of Medicine and a COVID-19 DSMB member, agreed to speak with CNN. "I think you feel powerful. You feel responsible. You know that everybody's trusting you with these data," she said. "We have certainly never been in a situation where the national leadership has seemed to be so involved, directly involved, in these kinds of processes," she told Dr. Gupta about President Trump's claims that the White House can overrule the FDA's attempt to toughen guidelines for a coronavirus vaccine. "Members of the board go through an extensive vetting process. We want to know they're fully independent, that they have no prior, you know, relationships with the company, so that they're not conflicted in any way," Dr. Eric Topol, a professor of molecular medicine at Scripps Research, said. Another 837,000 Americans filed for unemployment claims last week. America's jobs recovery continues, albeit at a slow pace, as another 837,000 Americans filed for first-time unemployment benefits last week on a seasonally adjusted basis. That was slightly fewer from the prior week, although last week's figures notably do not include updated numbers from California, which paused processing initial claims for 2 weeks. The state is working on a large backlog in benefits claims and implementing fraud prevention. The Labor Department estimated California's initial claims numbers by duplicating the prior week's reported claims figures. Claims under the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program that Congress created to help workers who wouldn't usually be eligible for benefits, such as the self-employed, stood at 650,120. Adding these together, there were 1.4 million total first-time claims for benefits last week, roughly even with the prior week. Continued claims, which count workers who have filed for benefits for at least 2 consecutive weeks, stood at 11.8 million on a seasonally adjusted basis. The slowing pace of the decline in jobless claims is another piece of evidence that the economic recovery is running out of steam. Thursday's Labor Department report on jobless claims is just the latest in the week's report card on the labor market. The government's jobs report, the last before the election, is due on Friday. Economists expect 850,000 jobs will be added back in September, bringing the unemployment rate to 8.2%, down from 8.4% in August. Majority of American families with children under 18 report serious financial impact from coronavirus pandemic, survey finds. Most U.S. families with children under 18 across all racial and ethnic groups are facing serious financial problems as a result of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, according to a new poll from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, NPR, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The survey found 61% of households in the U.S. with children under 18 were dealing with financial hardships due to the pandemic. The poll also found more than half of U.S. households experienced pay cuts or lost jobs over the same period of time. The poll was conducted from July 1st to August 3rd and involved 3,454 respondents, 18 years old and above, of whom 1,000 reported having children under 18 in their homes. The survey also found 44% of households with children reported spending all or most of their savings during the pandemic. 11% said they did not have any savings before the outbreak. 6 out of 10 families with children reported an adult in the home had lost a job, a business, was furloughed, or faced reduced wages or hours since the pandemic began, the poll found, leading to serious financial problems. Since the start of the pandemic, 59% of households with children had problems caring for their children, and 36% had trouble keeping their kids' schooling intact, the survey revealed. The poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 6 percentage points. Eviction fears continue despite moratorium. Where do I go with my kids? Families across the U.S. are struggling to pay rent and face evictions despite an eviction moratorium until the end of the year. In September, the Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued an order to temporarily halt evictions through the end of 2020. Uma Conte told CNN's Kaung La that she contracted COVID-19 in June at a nursing home where she worked. The Columbus, Ohio resident was out of work for 2 months and is now working as a home health care aide, making $12 an hour. She said she has now been given 30 days to pay the rent she owes. "I'm just thinking about my kids. Where do I go with my kids?" she said through tears. Melissa Benson of the Legal Aid Society of Columbus said the moratorium absolutely does not mean that cases aren't being filed against tenants. The order puts the responsibility on the renter to ensure they meet the criteria and to provide a signed written contract to their landlord in order to invoke the protection. It doesn't freeze rent or relieve tenants from having to pay back rent. "It's really overwhelming and scary. They could say we have to move out in a week and we don't know," said Shaylin Webb, mother of an 8-month-old. Kyung La reported that about half the people she spoke to in one day in Columbus worked in healthcare, the ones who walk by those hashtag signs that say, "Heroes work here." Where things stand on bipartisan negotiations for a stimulus. As the coronavirus pandemic continues to hammer the U.S. economy, House Democrats held off a planned vote Wednesday night on their $2.2 trillion stimulus proposal to allow more time for bipartisan negotiations in a last-ditch effort to reach a deal just weeks before Election Day. Latest on the negotiations. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin are still far apart, however, as negotiations continue, according to four sources briefed on the talks. Despite optimistic words from Pelosi and Mnuchin, sources briefed on the talks said that reaching an agreement with the backing of Senate GOP leaders and the White House remains a tall order. But for now, the two plan to continue talking, with House Democrats delaying a vote on their own plan to create room for the two sides to come closer to a deal on Thursday. The stimulus package. Still, the top-line cost of a final package, which had been the defining hurdle throughout weeks of inaction, has narrowed, the people said, with Mnuchin's proposal running above the $1.5 trillion that the Trump administration had signaled it was open to in the talks. But it remains short of the current $2.2 trillion House Democratic proposal, and it's far more than what Senate Republicans are willing to accept, given that their conference united around a $500 billion proposal. More importantly, the people said, the actual details of the various pieces remain far from ironed out, with issues like funds for state and local governments and the shape of liability protections still nowhere near agreement. Mnuchin told Fox News Wednesday night that President Donald Trump had instructed him and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to significantly increase the amount of money in a White House proposal. However, he would not say if there's a magical number that would lead to a deal. What comes next? Mnuchin said he would most likely speak with Pelosi again Wednesday night, but he didn't think there would be significant progress until Thursday, when the two sides plan to continue the conversation to try and add details to the talks and narrow differences. We're going to go back and do a little bit more work, Mnuchin told reporters as he left the Capitol Wednesday. We've made a lot of progress in a lot of areas. Time is running out, however, to strike a bipartisan deal before Election Day, and pressure is running high, with lawmakers facing questions from constituents in need amid the economic and public health fallout from the pandemic. Before we move on to our pre-recorded stories related to food insecurity in the United States, I have one more article I'm going to read. This one, another one about the different ways that Americans are struggling during the pandemic. Millions of Americans risk losing power and water as massive unpaid utility bills pile up. More than 179 million people may be at risk for shutoffs as many state protections end. This is from the Washington Post, written by Tony Rom. This Tuesday marked 67 days of darkness for Kenneth Parson. He fell behind on his utility bills in the spring, and his lights went off and stayed off starting at the end of July. No power meant no refrigerator, so Parson, a 62-year-old with diabetes in Griffin, Georgia, had no choice but to store his temperature-sensitive insulin on ice in a small cooler. He didn't have an easy way to cook at home either, so his wife Cheryl took to preparing some meals for him in a neighbor's kitchen. In those first few days after they lost electricity, Cheryl had pleaded on Parson's behalf with city officials who managed their local utilities, hoping she might change their minds in the middle of a pandemic that has left families nationwide struggling to cover their once manageable costs of living. They said they couldn't do anything for him, lamented Cheryl, 65, who lives apart from her husband but remains married and helps him manage his health conditions. It peeved me off. The worst economic crisis in more than a generation has thrust potentially millions of Americans across the country into similar sudden peril. Cash-strapped and, in some cases, still unemployed, they have fallen far behind on their electricity, water, and gas bills, staring down the prospect of potential utility shutoffs and fast-growing debts they may never be able to repay. At the start of the coronavirus pandemic, many states acted quickly to ensure their residents would not lose their power or other utilities if their jobs or wages were slashed. Now, however, only 21 states and the District of Columbia still have such disconnection bans in place. That leaves roughly 179 million Americans at risk of losing service even as the economy continues sputtering, according to the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, which is tracking the moratoria. Millions more in nine other states are set to lose their protections starting Thursday and throughout the fall, the group found. Americans nationwide also appear to be racking up massive unpaid bills in the process. Electric and gas debts alone threaten to reach or exceed $24.3 billion by the end of the year, according to a new NEADA analysis released Thursday, based on roughly two dozen states' regulatory filings. In some cases, the delinquencies appear to be severe. In Indiana, for example, More than 112,000 households are behind 120 days or more on their power bills, a Washington Post analysis of the largest local energy company's records found. The debt, totaling millions of dollars, is four times greater than the arrears accrued during the same period in 2019, the data showed. The people who were struggling before are struggling even more, said Mark Wolf, the NADA's executive director. Utility companies generally are not required to disclose how many Americans are behind on their payments and by how much, complicating efforts to study the effects of the pandemic and craft effective policy responses. In some cases, power, water, and gas providers have actively lobbied against the kind of robust shutoff moratoria that advocates say are essential. But the scattershot data and grim anecdotal tales appear to point to the same conclusion. Americans already on the financial precipice are coming even closer to the edge. Such a crisis threatens not only their health and well-being, but that of the utilities themselves, some of which are already signaling they may have to raise rates or take other drastic steps to make up for their anticipated losses. You can't really underestimate the burden of that debt on families, said Khalil Shaid, a senior policy advocate at the Natural Resources Defense Council. It's going to have wider ramifications for our economy and our ability to recover from this crisis. The torrent of missed electric, water, and gas payments underscores the severe cash crunch that continues to plague Americans nearly 7 months after the deadly coronavirus sent the U.S. economy into a tailspin. Nationally, nearly one-third of adults still say they face difficulty meeting their regular household expenses, according to the most recent survey by the U.S. Census Bureau. That dour figure is compounded by the fact that 837,000 new workers filed for unemployment assistance last week, the U.S. government reported Thursday. At the height of the crisis, Congress in the spring responded with nearly $3 trillion in stimulus spending that aimed to boost unemployed workers' weekly benefits, dispatch one-time checks to all Americans, and augment existing safety net programs, including funds to help Americans pay for their electricity. But much of the money has been spent or has expired. All the while, lawmakers have bickered over the need for another round of relief. The data paints a grim picture, said Senator Thomas R. Carper, the top Democrat on the chamber's Environment and Public Works Committee, adding that lawmakers need to come together and do something that brings relief to Americans who are hurting right now. Outside of Washington, Americans' wide-ranging economic struggles have been laid bare in little-noticed regulatory filings by the water, power, and gas companies that are supposed to serve them. In Wisconsin, residents fell behind on their electricity bills in August. An average of 3 in 10 customers at 5 electric and gas utilities missed payments, totaling $235 million in arrears, state records show. That's more than double the average rate they registered in 2019, according to a presentation filed this month in a regulatory proceeding. As the coronavirus ravages the state, Wisconsin's Utility Commission last month opted to extend its shutoff moratorium into next spring, aiming to protect public health and ensure students stuck learning at home aren't trying to do so in the dark. The curve is going the wrong way, said Rebecca Cameron Valk, who chairs the regulatory body. We are seeing large-scale spread, and to take away people's ability to practice the proper hygiene and to practice social distancing, the last thing we needed to do was to allow their utilities to be disconnected. More than 68,000 Nevada residents and small businesses were behind on their payments last month, the Nevada Power Company recently told regulators, and half are past due by more than 90 days. The energy provider said that it has left it facing $29.5 million in arrears by mid-August, four times as much as the same time last year. The company did not respond to a request for comment. In many ways, the late or missing payments stem from the fact that states merely suspended collections, disconnections, and late fees, but didn't waive the bills that Americans racked up. Much like the country's emerging housing crisis, as renters deferred monthly payments without risk of eviction, so too did many families hold off on paying their water, electricity, or gas. In both cases, these families may owe potentially insurmountable sums once they come due, only adding to their financial woes. I imagine if people accumulate a lot of utility debt during the moratorium and while they were laid off, it's going to be really difficult for people to catch up, said Mary Grant, who oversees work on water policy at Food and Water Watch, an advocacy group. Less than half of the country is protected from water shutoffs, she said, and another 26 cities and states are set to allow their protections to expire over the next month. Nationwide, many states have faced a difficult choice in deciding whether to extend or terminate their shutoff protections as the economy has started to rebound. Some states have often relaxed their rules as power providers and other utilities commit to voluntary measures, including efforts making it easier for their customers to enroll in payment plans. But local regulators have also faced a barrage of lobbying on the part of utilities, which have sounded alarms that long-term moratoria may leave them unable to collect on Americans' ever-growing unpaid bills. An Association for Energy Providers in Pennsylvania said in its August correspondence with the state that it had registered $403 million in arrears compared with $290 million at the same time in 2019. In doing so, the lobbying group still urged the Keystone State to cancel its shutoff moratorium, arguing that circumstances have changed since March, and other solutions, such as payment plans, would work better. This situation isn't good for the customers who are falling behind. It's not good for the general body of ratepayers because they're going to be called on to pay for some part of that debt expense. And it's not good for utility shareholders who face the risk of the money not being recovered, said Terry Fitzpatrick, the president of the Energy Association of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania ultimately did not act on the request, essentially keeping the disconnection ban in place. But local activists expressed alarm at the potential financial hurt on the horizon. All the dominoes are about to fall, said Elizabeth Marks, the executive director of the Pennsylvania Utility Law Project, which advocates on behalf of low-income residents in need. When you lift the moratorium, those households that are struggling will be worse off. These regulatory decisions carry great weight. Utility companies could later try to seek permission to raise rates on everyone if they experience substantial losses. A slew of unpaid utility bills in 2020 could mean higher prices for Americans in 2021 or beyond, a likely outcome in the eyes of some industry analysts. Their cash flow is becoming more strapped because they're not collecting that money from ratepayers, but there still are incremental costs to providing service, said Lillian Federico, a research director tracking energy at S&P Global. As you get further down the line, utility commissions are going to have to decide, do we want to allow to have companies recover these arrearages? The stakes are even higher in communities where municipalities own their own water, electric, or gas utilities. With local budgets in disarray and billions of dollars in long-sought local aid unlikely to come from Washington, many of these cities simply cannot afford the kind of losses their investor-owned counterparts might be able to stomach. In North Carolina, roughly 1 million residents over the summer fell behind on their utility bills, leading rural cities to beg the state to cancel its moratorium. In Georgia, meanwhile, the state's short-lived utility shutoff moratorium applied only to private entities such as Georgia Power. But municipally owned power sources, including in Griffin, the city of 23,000 where the Parson family lives, had followed suit voluntarily for only a short time, according to Georgia Watch, a local advocacy group. The city's manager did not respond to a request for comment. Even without the short-term bans, the arrival of cold weather automatically triggers seasonal protections throughout the country, giving Americans at least some relief entering the more expensive winter months. But those bans vary widely, and in some cases, they protect only certain low-income residents from utility shutoffs, a far cry from the more robust rules put in place earlier in the pandemic. Instead, advocates across the country say the real solution must be federal in nature, beginning with billions of dollars in new spending to help low-income Americans pay their utility bills. For one thing, one of the government's major programs, known in the industry as LIHEAP, covers energy and not water service. House lawmakers recently proposed funding to help families cover their water bills, but it has not gained significant traction, even at a time when hand-washing is paramount. Absent another injection of federal aid, Wolf, who represents state energy officials at the NADA, described the situation as a cliff on the imminent horizon for potentially millions of Americans nationwide. The current system, he said, is not designed to help that many people. Now we're going to move on to our pre-recorded reports that are related to food insecurity. We're fairly far along in the hour. We'll try and get as many of these in as possible. Our first article deals with veterans. COVID-19 pandemic threatens homeless vets.
The pandemic appears to be reversing years of progress in getting homeless American veterans off the streets. Over the past decade, homelessness among veterans dropped by about half through the work of the VA and community organizations, as well as massive funding from the government. Now what happens? NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
The National Coalition for Homeless Veterans had its annual conference this week.
All right, you guys, welcome to today's sessions.
All virtual, of course. Homelessness is counted each year across the country, usually in winter when more people come into shelters. The results of the count come out in the fall, which means the official number this year will show no effects from the pandemic or the recession. So no one knows what the real number is.
We're hearing from our members across the country that more veterans than ever are reaching out for help.
Catherine Monet leads the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans. She says attendance online for the conference is high, and she's hearing troubling stories.
We're getting more calls from people who have eviction notices and are unsure about what to do or where to go for help if it's their first time trying to navigate the system.
That's borne out on the ground in places that were success stories. New Orleans had reached what's called functional zero 5 years ago. That means all the known homeless veterans had been offered housing, and resources were in place to house any vets who became newly homeless. Devon Phillips does outreach in New Orleans for Volunteers of America. He's getting calls from veterans who've never asked for help before.
We have a lady now. She's living with her kids and facing eviction because she lost her job. Coming into the program now, new, she actually have an interview that's coming up. The interview is for a job, paying a little less, but the kids are now virtual learning, and many families don't have the support to do child care and have someone to pay for child care.
Evictions are still banned in some parts of the country, but those protections are starting to fade, and for many tenants, the rent was just deferred. In a way, veterans are lucky. Even in this crisis, there are vast resources put aside to help them. The government provides special vouchers for veterans' housing, and VA health care is there as a safety net. Los Angeles has the highest number of homeless and homeless veterans in the country. That's where Steve Peck runs the nonprofit U.S. Vets.
There's been a lot of money available very quickly because the government realized the dramatic impact this is going to have on people and businesses.
Peck says the pandemic has meant lower occupancy at the 11 housing communities he runs, since homeless vets are avoiding group housing because of the virus. But he says the VA has been funding him at the same level. He says keeping organizations like his funded is the way to prepare for what he expects will be an uptick of homelessness in the future. But Peck says many of the stimulus programs that we're helping will expire next month.
But this money is running out. The costs aren't going to go away. The pandemic won't be over in October. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen after that.
There are measures moving through Congress to expand support for homeless veterans, but that help, along with a possible second stimulus bill, now appears to be falling behind as the pandemic marches on. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Our next two reports about how food insecurity is affecting families. The first report, for one food insecure family, the pandemic leaves no wiggle room. And the next report will be, in pandemic, many students lose critical access to meals.
That challenging food environment we just heard about is exactly what one family near Champaign, Illinois, has been coping with since the start of the pandemic. Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin has their story.
Everything the Pleasure family cooks and eats revolves around their garden.
We have gotten a lot of tomatoes from this one.
10-year-old Joshua has been gardening since he was little. Right now, the family's community garden plot is planted with fall squash.
Oh, I'm cooking literally every day with something that I've grown, every day, which I absolutely love because it saves trips to the grocery store.
Joshua's mom, Janelle Pleasure, says food has always been central to her family. One of their favorite activities is to spin a globe, put a finger down, and cook a dish from that country. But they haven't done that since the start of the pandemic, when Pleasure says things got hard.
There's not a belt to tighten. There's no wiggle room here. I have, you know, I'm unemployed, and there are limited things that I can do.
She became a single mom of three kids when her husband left 2 years ago. Without his stream of income, it became difficult to afford the basics, including food. Then came the pandemic. She lost her job almost immediately, and when her kids' schools shut down, it meant no more school meals. She is, however, receiving $125 per month through an expanded food stamps program.
Literally, the $125 I can spend in like a week because my kids eat like grown men, like a football team. I don't know where they put it.
Pleasure doesn't waste anything. Her kitchen counter is lined with jars of pickled vegetables from the garden, and her freezer is stacked with leftovers. A self-described coupon queen, she shows off her pantry, where she stockpiles food she finds on sale.
They're organic, made with fruit juice, and they're like fruit pops, but these are normally, what did she say, $6.59, and I got them for a dollar. I was like, I'm going to take 40 of those. Thank you.
And yet, sometimes it's not enough. That's when she pays a visit to the local food pantry where her kids used to volunteer.
When we actually had to be participants in it, I think maybe there was a little bit of confusion for them. Like, I don't want to put words in their mouths, but it maybe was a little shameful. Like, why are we here? Why do we have to do this? So I stopped bringing them because looking at that and looking at them, it made me feel like less of a parent.
Pleasure is far from alone in the struggle to afford food. In fact, food insecurity rates for families with children have tripled during the pandemic, and families of color are even worse off. Black families like the Pleasures report rates of food insecurity twice that of white families. Experts say the easiest way for the government to help would be to increase food stamp benefits. Janelle Pleasure says she's grateful for the help she has received.
That took like a huge weight off my shoulders because now I just have to worry about, will the power be on, you know, as opposed to power or food. I'd rather my kids eat than have lights. Like, you know, we can get candles. Not a big deal.
Even if it was in the dark, she says she's always been able to put some kind of food on the table. For NPR News, I'm Dana Cronin in Champaign.
Schools are a lifeline for many parents struggling to feed their families. Free and reduced lunch programs aim to help students get access to nutritious meals. But when most of the nation's K through 12 schools shut down in the spring, these programs transformed almost overnight. With cafeterias closed, schools began handing out bagged meals in their parking lots. In the early days of the pandemic, this seemed to work pretty well. But NPR's Corey Turner reports too many kids are now missing out on the meals they need.
Before COVID-19, Arizona's Tucson Unified School District dished out a lot of meals.
A normal school day, we serve 35,000 total meals a day. That's breakfast, lunch, and supper.
Lindsay Aguilar is the district's food services director. When I spoke with her earlier this month, she said the number of meals served so far this year had plummeted by nearly 90%. That's because lots of parents and caregivers are back at work and can't get to the meal pickup sites each day.
It's disheartening because I know those kids, you know, they still are in need of the food, and families are struggling even more now than ever.
Aguilar says she feels a huge responsibility to do more to reach those kids who need those 35,000 meals a day.
realistically, I know I'm not going to get 35,000, but can I get 10? Can I get 12? You know, how can I get these families to come, or how can I get to them? I joke all the time, but I'm like, we need Amazon Prime out of our warehouse.
We come up with ways every week to find a new way to get meals to our kids.
Alicia Wright heads the nutrition program for schools in Fulton County, Georgia. And she, like nutrition directors all over the country, says she's losing sleep thinking about how to reach the children who can't reach them.
Every day. I worry about them every day. I think about it every night.
Wright and her team are freezing hamburgers and lasagna rolls so they can pack a whole week's worth of meals into just one pickup.
My best day was last week.
That's because Wright and her team were testing a new plan to pack all that food onto a school bus to get closer to the kids who need it. Parents and caregivers were thrilled, Wright says, telling her,
this is so great because we could not get to the food stop. We didn't have transportation.
In Tucson, Aguilar and her team are also packing meals onto buses and delivering them at more than 60 stops. And it all matters, says researcher Lauren Bauer at the Brookings Institution, because 1 in 5 families say their kids aren't getting enough food and they don't have enough resources to buy more.
That means that children are going hungry.
And Bauer says the vast majority of kids who could be getting school meals aren't. While schools are doing everything they can to change that, Congress is also trying to help. In the spring, lawmakers created a program called Pandemic EBT. It basically took the value of those school meals that kids weren't getting and put it, usually a few $100s, onto a debit card that families could then use at the grocery store. Lauren Bauer says Pandemic EBT reached a lot of families.
And it kept between 2.5 and 3.5 million children out of hunger this summer.
The program was set to expire by the end of September, but in a rare show of bipartisanship, the House recently voted overwhelmingly in support of an extension through fiscal year 2021. The Senate is expected to do the same. Corey Turner, NPR News.
For months, we've talked about federal help. Even just today, we've talked about Steven Mnuchin and Nancy Pelosi going forward with talks for a new stimulus bill. And earlier, we also read the article about utility shutoff moratoriums that have ended or are set to expire soon, affecting millions of Americans. Here's a report that relates to that. This story is federal food assistance programs alone fall short for Americans.
We're going to focus now on the programs that are meant to address this basic need. What does the government provide, and where has it fallen short? Joining us now to tell us more is NPR's food and agriculture correspondent, Dan Charles. Dan, welcome.
Good to be here.
So first of all, would you just tell us about the systems that are currently in place to help people get access to the food they need, especially now in the middle of this pandemic?
The backbone of that system is called SNAP. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. This program has its limits, which I'll get to, but it is really important and probably does not get enough credit.
And that's what used to be called food stamps?
That's right. There are a couple of things about SNAP that just make it great. First of all, it's really quick in responding to a crisis like this. You sign up, benefits get loaded electronically on a card. Instantly, you can go to a grocery store and buy food. I find that kind of amazing. The other thing is it is really efficient. It takes advantage of the normal commercial supply chain for food. You know, like grocery stores, they're already there. The government doesn't have to come up with a new way of delivering food. And it can handle huge numbers of people. More than 1 out of 8 Americans is in this program right now.
What about the paperwork involved, though? You have to prove you qualify. Is that a barrier to participation?
Well, it is a barrier. I mean, you have to provide documentation of income, residency, and you can imagine, I mean, that can be a problem. If, let's say, you've just been evicted, you've lost your address, that can make things really hard. Or also, part of the rules of the program are, if you're an undocumented immigrant, you do not qualify. Your American-born children who are citizens, they do qualify, but there's evidence that a lot of families who are in that situation don't even try to get into the program.
I can imagine there's a lot of sort of philosophical and political opinion behind that qualification or that standard. But what about the benefit level? I mean, is it enough to meet the need? If you lost your job and you're trying to provide healthy food to your children, sufficient healthy food to your children, Can you do it with SNAP?
It is hard. The benefit level was set up to meet some minimum requirement, and according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is sufficient. But we're talking just a few dollars a day per person, right? $150 to $200 a month. That's the maximum SNAP benefit. That would be really hard.
Could the government increase those benefits?
Yes, it could. And there is a big political fight going on right now about that. Now, I should say the Trump administration did bump everybody in the program up to that maximum level. But the Democrats want to go further and increase the maximum level by 15%. That's what the Obama administration did during the Great Recession 10 years ago. The Democrats passed a provision like that in the House, but the Senate has not gone along.
Dan, I think a lot of people might remember pictures and stories that we heard from earlier in this year, and especially in the growing season, when we saw pictures of like milk being poured down the drain or vegetables and fruits being left to rot in the fields because farmers couldn't get those items to their customers because everything was shut down. Why is that happening? Like, why couldn't these farmers get these products to the people who needed food?
Food supply chains are amazing and they're really efficient, but they're sometimes inflexible. For instance, a vast majority of the tomatoes in Florida are grown for what they call food service. You know, that's cruise ships and restaurants and stores. That's how they package the tomatoes. That's the kind of tomatoes they grow. And suddenly, with the lockdown, those places went out of business. They couldn't just like send them to the grocery store. They didn't have that relationship and they weren't growing the type of product that was easy to send to a grocery store. It was like a total collapse of the system, but it was pretty brief. And you're not seeing, basically farmers are not destroying crops and dairy farmers are not dumping milk anymore. People have adjusted.
I was going to ask you about that. There was this Farmers to Families program. The point was to buy food that farmers were having trouble selling and distribute it through food banks. Is this up and running and has this been effective?
It is up and running. They funded it with $4 billion. They've delivered tens of millions of these food boxes to food banks for distribution. But the program has had a lot of problems, to be honest. Contractors were supposed to deliver food, these boxes, all the way to, you know, the trunks of cars. Many of them didn't do it, so food banks had to spend a lot of money taking over that job. Food didn't necessarily go to the places where it was most needed. And honestly, it was just not very efficient. Setting up a new supply chain was really expensive and takes a lot of work. And, you know, compared to the amount of money they spent on that program, the same amount of money distributed through SNAP would have delivered a lot more food.
So I see your point, Dan, about sort of the efficiencies here. But is money for SNAP, more money for SNAP, all that's needed? I mean, from what we're hearing, there are all kinds of, you know, distribution glitches here, all kinds of kind of mismatches between the need, where the food's being produced, how the food gets to the people who need it. And it just seems like there are a lot of food and nutrition problems that this one program isn't solving. Is that right?
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, when you step back and think about it, let's take the example of SNAP. You got your SNAP benefits card, you got your benefits, you go try to find food at the grocery store. There are a lot of places in the country where, for reasons of poverty and all kinds of reasons, it is pretty hard to find stores that are selling a lot of good fresh produce. There are neighborhoods where the corner stores are not great. There are rural areas and small towns where all you have is something like a Dollar General. And so that's the food environment, and that's a much bigger problem. That was the situation before the pandemic, and I'm afraid it's still going to be the case when the pandemic passes.
That is Dan Charles, NPR's food and agriculture correspondent. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In our final report that we have time for this hour, we're going to continue about federal aid. This is a report about how expanded Medicaid could help improve food security.
It seems fairly obvious that one of the root causes of food insecurity is poverty. If you don't have enough money, then it stands to reason that it's likely to be hard to get enough food, or at least enough good, nutritious food on a regular basis. But what might not be so obvious is why so many people in the United States are still in poverty. According to recent data from the U.S. Census Bureau, the number one factor driving Americans into poverty is medical expenses. That's right, medical expenses. In 2019 alone, nearly 8 million Americans fell below the poverty line because of medical bills. Anti-poverty advocates say one solution to that problem is to expand Medicaid across the country. Jim Carnes is one of those people. He is the policy director of Alabama Arise, a nonprofit that's advocating for policies to end poverty in Alabama, including by expanding Medicaid. And he is with us now from Montgomery. Jim Carnes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
So walk me through this. I mean, how do medical expenses end up forcing Americans into poverty? And I ask because I think a lot of people would assume that Medicaid, which is a program to provide medical care to people of low income, would keep that from happening. So how does this work?
Well, the Census Bureau measures poverty in two different ways. The older way that we've been doing for 50 plus years is strictly cash income based, and it looks at how many households have cash income less than three times the cost of what the Health and Human Services Department calls a minimum food diet for their family size. So the second way is called the supplemental poverty measure, and it takes into account things beyond just cash income. It takes into account additional resources in a family, such as public benefits that are designed to help lift people out of poverty, things like food stamps and rental assistance and things like that. It also takes into account expenses that are not a part of their traditional basic expense spectrum, like rent and transportation and food and clothing and that sort of thing. So it takes into account things that reduce the available resources in a family. And the factor that reduces household income or spending money, you might say, the most is medical debt.
Break it down for me. Like, how does that work? What tends to be the case? Is it people with chronic health conditions and the cost of treating those conditions is high, or is it a catastrophic incident? Why is it that medical expenses force people, that many people, into poverty every year?
Yeah, there are a number of factors moving at the same time. A huge one is the number of people without health insurance. But particularly in states like Alabama, which is one of 12 states that have not accepted Medicaid expansion, we have hundreds of thousands of people who don't have that safety net. So number one, they don't have somebody helping them pay their medical bills. When that's the case, a number of other factors kick into play. So you have people who are delaying getting medical care because they don't have a way to pay for it. And when their problem gets unavoidable and they do have to seek care, that care is more expensive because it's late and their condition is worse. So the bills are higher.
Is the connection between health care costs, poverty, and food insecurity one that is starting to make sense to people? Are people starting to connect the dots? Because it's not, I mean, if you've lived it, you can see why people would understand it. But if they've never lived through it, then maybe it's not as real. And I just wondered if people are seeing that connection at all.
I think they are. Our state government has chosen three factors to target to try to improve. And those are obesity, infant mortality, and substance use disorders. So the fact that the state and our state leaders are recognizing that we really have to do something about these terrible health outcomes that are related to nutrition tells me that they are opening up to solutions that they may not have considered before.
Before we let you go, as you surely know, Supreme Court Justice, Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died recently. There is now a vacancy on the High Court, and we know that the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear a case that could possibly overturn the Affordable Care Act this fall, which could greatly affect Medicaid expansion. If that happens, I mean, I recognize that's a hypothetical. Where do you go from there?
Rest assured that the advocates around the country are going to be staying in the fight to continue to address the gaping holes in our healthcare system. And there are other ways to go about that work. So we'll will just pick up. I'm hoping and praying that it doesn't come to that, that the path forward will be moving up the same path we've had and reaching the goal. But if we don't, and if we get thrown off that path, we'll make another one.
That's Jim Carnes, Policy Director at Alabama Arise.